This is The Think Tank, talking about the major economic, political, and social issues of the week on the Voice of Arizona, News Talk 92.3 KTAR. Here's Dr. Mike O'Neill and Mike Russell.
There we are. It is the 2000.
Turn your mic on there, Doc. Come on now. That one. That button.
Okay.
You knew here?
Thank you, technical expert.
All right, I got it.
This is the 2014 legislative wrap-up show. The legislature's out of session. Howie, are we out of danger here? That'd be first question. No, let me introduce our guest first. Howie Fisher alluded to there briefly. Yvonne Winget Sanchez and Mary Jo Pitzel, both from the Arizona Republic. Howie Fisher from Arizona Capital Times. I don't want to start with that question, but you can infer your answer into the first question, which is, all right, the legislature is out of session. They may come back for a special session or two or three. But what's the big headline story? Start with you, Howie. For the whole year, what's the number one story out of this session?
Well, I suppose it always becomes the budget. You know, the fact is that we do have a, and I'll use the term loosely, a balanced budget, that the amount of money being spent is equal to what they've got in the account. Now, the other half of that is it's not really a balanced budget because we're living off of perhaps $600 million that's a carry forward from the 1 cent sales tax that expired last May 31st.
And there's a little bit of that money left.
There's a little bit of that money left. We are actually spending more than we're taking in. Now, we can do that for a while, but unless you
believe— This year's it, right?
I mean, this year's pretty much it. And depending on whose predictions you're talking about, 2 years from now, we could be $500 million in the hole. Now, the governor's economist is saying, oh, no, we're going to grow at 5%. Manufacturing is going to come back. The birds will sing. The bees will buzz. And things will be great. Some other economists are saying, not so much. And that's the big shoe that's left to drop.
Mary Jo, big story of this session. What is it?
Big story is they did a budget and passed bills and got done in 101 days. Not terribly sexy headline, but they got down to business. Senate President Andy Biggs, you know, says, look, you got to take a look at what happened in 2014 against the backdrop of last year when we had the big fight over Medicaid expansion, when Biggs was, you know, possibly going to be tossed out. House Speaker Andy Tobin was going to be rolled out of his office. Well, this year they kept it together. The caucuses held together. There were no coup attempts. They worked together mostly like adults and got a budget out. And then 2 weeks later finished up all the work on the bills.
Yvonne, to you, what's the big story?
I think the big story from the governor's office perspective this year was her veto of 1062, the refuse to serve bill that once again catapulted her to the international spotlight.
But on the other side, on the other side of the issue, in a way.
Well, certainly. I mean, she went against her own party and a sometime supporter, Kathy Herod, on this thing. So she, you know, she earned some criticism on that as well.
Let me throw out kind of my subtext, at least a subtext to the big story, and get you to react to that. There seemed to be a kind of an alliance between the governor and sort of a small moderate wing within the Republican coalition.
Well, this was an extension of what happened last year that Mary Jo alluded to with the Medicaid expansion.
Largely the same coalition?
Largely the same coalition of folks who have decided that, you know, perhaps we don't want to destroy Common Core. We don't want to have a massive expansion of voucher programs. We do want a budget that does give some money to education. And the governor, who has always referred to herself as a pragmatist, looked for those who were willing to align themselves with her. Now, she didn't need the Democrats this year as she did, you know, last year in terms of Medicaid expansion and the budget. But she managed to have enough people who were there. There were enough people to block what the more conservative elements of the Republican Party wanted to do to give her more of a voice than she would otherwise have.
So that's kind of a different arithmetic. If you're trying to stop the far-right conservatives from doing something, you don't need Democrats for that. You only need a handful of Republicans. Mm-hmm. If you're trying to proactively do something like Medicaid, you need the Democrats too.
Yeah. And I will note that the governor was slow to activate that coalition that you referenced. It was only in the last couple of weeks of the session that she actually turned to them. They had been struggling with some of the education bills and with some of the CPS legislation, and they were hearing nothing from the ninth floor until the final weeks.
Okay. So we've had a governor. This is, I think, Jan Brewer's last hurrah. She has never lost an election in over 30 years in public office. She's retiring. She's finally given up the charade that she's, you know, eligible. So, Howie, what do you think is her legacy?
Well, I think certainly she would say her legacy is that she inherited a $3 billion deficit and that she managed to pull the state out of it without either bankrupting the state or without cuts that were more severe. I mean, there were people, and you know, Mary Jo certainly has seen this, who wanted to cut the state budget by $3 billion. Well, when you're starting from 9 and want to cut the state budget to 6, you know, and given that some of this is set by formula, like state aid to schools, you know, you'd be destroying government. So what the governor came up with was essentially a 1-1-1 plan. We will cut $1 billion, we will borrow $1 billion, and we will do the temporary tax. I think that becomes her legacy in her own mind. Now, there are other things, Medicaid
expansion.
Sort of a
manager who's balanced various interests.
Well, she did inherit a mess. And, you know, Janet Napolitano, one step out the door to go play at the Obama administration, had basically said, oh, we don't need to cut government. Things will be wonderful. And yet she was responsible for a 10% cut in income taxes because she traded that for full-day kindergarten, which went away. So,
Napolitano was governor at a time when every year the state was bursting at the seams with more revenue without tax increases.
Not every year. In her early days, there actually was a bit of a recession, and she had to pull them out of a hole. But that was early in her mm-hmm. first term.
But she had the luxury of being able to allow the Republicans to cut taxes, and still she had more revenue to play with. So she didn't have to face that kind of hard choices, really. Legacy.
Well, as much as Jan Brewer might want to talk about what she did with the budget, that doesn't resonate with the public. She's going to be remembered for her signature on Senate Bill 1070 and for her work on Medicaid expansion and overhauling the Child Protective Services Agency, although we've yet to see the final.
We've got just 30 seconds. I want to let Yvonne in.
I agree with Mary Jo. I mean, I think her legacy is going to be 1070, and with Latinos, it's not going to be a good legacy. A lot of Democrats, too. I mean, she's leaving behind, you know, a disenfranchised group of people who are really going to be happy to see her go.
And none of you mentioned child welfare, which is interesting to me. We're going to get to that here shortly. Let's do that after the break, right here on the Think Tank, Newstalk 92.3 KTAO.
You're listening to the Think Tank on the Voice of Arizona, Newstalk 92.3
KTAR. We are here back again with our crack team of legislative reporters reviewing the 2014 legislative legacy. Yvonne Winget-Sanchez, you were making an interesting point at the end, and I think the necessities of time and commercial cut off your comment. You were commenting about the governor's action to, I think, 1070 being part of it, and long-term legacy vis-a-vis the Hispanic community. And I wonder if you might elaborate on that and also answer, do you think this is fatal in terms of the Republicans' desire to make inroads with Hispanics over the next, say, 10 years?
Well, certainly for the short term, when you talk about Jan Brewer's legacy, and I guess even long term, with Latinos, she's, you know, some people call her La Bruja, the witch. I mean, they do not have a good image of Jan Brewer. They are very happy to see her go. You talk to people down in Mexico, Sonora, Arizona's one of Arizona's largest trading partners, leaders there. They're happy to see her go as well. They don't think she's been a friend to immigrants, first, second, third generation Latinos. And, you know, that has caused some damage to the state's reputation. Whether it will be long term, I guess that will remain to be seen.
1070 certainly did become a signature issue for her, even though we all seem to have forgotten the fact that she wasn't a prime mover behind it. She was late to the party, but she did fully endorse it.
Mm-hmm. Well, not only she endorsed it, but she's made a national reputation for herself, backing it, taking it to court. We all remember the little finger wagging scene on the tarmac at Sky Harbor.
That's clearly that may not be her legacy, but that's probably her visual.
If you could, if you could draw a picture of her time as governor, that would be it.
But whatever she and the Republicans think they're losing in the Latino community. And that may be a mistake on their part, given the demographics of the state. They're trying to pick up with the anti-federal government crew, the Clive Bundy crew of the world, the folks who are lashing out the federal government. You know, we know better. We are a sovereign state, 10th Amendment, the whole routine. We can graze our cattle here. We can do what we want. You know, if you're not going to secure the border, we will. And they've tapped into a deep vein here. Not a new vein. I mean, you remember the Sagebrush Rebellion.
Oh, yeah.
The whole routine.
Same kind of folks.
Same kind of folks. And somehow the Republican Party has decided their future is with battling the federal government, whatever they're doing.
Yeah. Interesting. People who, to a very great extent, a lot of those folks, their livelihood is dependent upon massive federal water projects that made Arizona and arid lands like ours habitable in the first place.
Will you stop interjecting logic into this?
You know, I want to sort of close the comment on Governor Brewer. There was a neighbor of mine, his name is Steve Rector, and he made, I thought, was a really brilliant comment about, well, he said his conclusion was, she's really been a governor. And he said, I mean that in the engineering sense. Mm-hmm. What does a governor do? A governor in the engineering sense is something, when something goes way off to the kilter, they kind of bring it back. And so we saw that. I mean, she was not a prime mover behind 1070, but that was widely supported at the time. Then we get some of these more recent gun bills, and she's an advocate of gun rights and all that, but some of this stuff went pretty far afield. She said, no, too much. She's not a big spender, but when we get a deal like we got with Medicaid, it is business foolish mm-hmm. to turn that down. It's $1 billion to the state at almost no cost. And that there is kind of a common thread through that. She's a governor in the sense of bringing things back to some sort of equilibrium.
Yeah, I would totally agree with that. She's got her foot on the brake pedal. That's the only thing between her and some of these bills that that have come out of our GOP-controlled legislature that get a lot of national headlines and not in a good sense. You know, this is what lands Arizona on The Daily Show and on Comedy Central. So she has, exercised her veto. And as you mentioned, with a lot of the gun bills, this is a Republican who pushed for and got a tax increase to help the state budget. And it was widely successful. I mean, it was
and
a 60-something.
That's heresy, but she did it at a moment when the state was facing a catastrophic loss of revenue.
Yes.
So this was against, I think, every instinct that she has. But she is deep down enough of a pragmatist to say, while I really don't like taxes, I don't want to raise them, this is a singular situation.
One of my colleagues was at the Victory Party the night that sales tax passed, and the governor took the podium, and he noted that up there on the dais with her was not one fellow Republican lawmaker. It was Jan Brewer with the firefighters and the teachers and the people that made the push for the sales tax.
All the people that voted against her.
Yeah, at least earlier. Yeah.
I mean, for election, but they didn't pull the R button when they voted. Yvonne, big winner. We're going to go through real quick winners and losers. Who do you think the big winner of this session is?
I think Jan had a nice final legislative session. She had a partial win on CPS. She got what she wanted on the manufacturing electricity tax cut for manufacturers. She finally got her human trafficking bill. And she'll probably get much of what she wants in the upcoming special session on CPS.
Big winner, I don't know, the status quo. I mean, not a whole lot changed. You know, some of the she just vetoed a tax bill yesterday, saying, "Look, we might need that money for child welfare." Some of these innovative projects like allowing Uber and Lyft and Tesla Motors to market in the state, those things didn't happen in the legislature. One was vetoed, one was voted down. Expansion of the voucher program didn't happen.
And that was a big expansion.
Yeah. Budget, increases for education were very, very modest. So I'd say the winner is status quo.
I agree with that. In looking at the budgets, the sort of legislative alternative to Brewer's, but they were arguing over trifles in the way of differences. I mean, and yes, the CPS increase that she called for was a big one, but it was a big increase of a small number.
Yeah.
It wasn't big numbers in terms of the overall $10 billion or so state budget. Howie?
Well, I think, playing off of what you were saying, I think if there was a winner, it is child welfare. that finally it got the attention it needed. Now, it took 6,600 uninvestigated cases to do that. Now, how long does this continue? You know, how long does the good feelings continue? We'll see in the special session.
We'll get back to that in a minute. I want to go back one more time. Big losers.
Pot. I mean, marijuana. It didn't. Pot supporters wanted access to fees generated by pot smokers to help fund research for veterans. It didn't happen this year.
Mary Jo.
Oh, big losers. I mean, when you say this, when I say the status quo won, then I guess innovation, you know, new ways of doing things, lost out.
I think a lot of the conservative movement were losers. Kathy Herod, in terms of, you know, Kathy used to be able to get pretty much what she wanted, and Ron Johnson from the Catholic Conference, and the folks pushing vouchers, and that they couldn't just push through any darn thing that they wanted this year. And that's a key.
I think a year ago, most people in the state wouldn't have known who Kathy Herod was. They do now, and not necessarily, and it may be in a sense of being a negative potential symbol to be used.
And shocking to say in a red state. But I think guns lost in this section, in this session, didn't they? I think that's safe to say. In a red state? Come on. This is Arizona.
This state has gone so far in loosening up its gun regulations that there's like, what else can you do?
That's been the problem. And I think there are
Georgia answered that question.
But there are issues, real quickly, that there are groups like the Citizens Defense League, which are looking for issues, looking for marginal issues just to push it, like the guns in public buildings. And that's what we've come to.
Right. We'll get to guns, and I promise we're getting to child welfare next, right here on the Think Tank. News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
You're listening to the Think Tank on the Voice of Arizona. News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
Now, what did you say, Doc? Seriously, we lost one of our panelists. Well, what did you say over the break?
Well,
she went storming out of here in a blaze of fury.
You leave me speechless.
Oh, come on. See, I usually, that's my job.
Well, maybe she's going to go track down our traveling governor. Our governor was on the road much of last week going and campaigning for folks in Atlanta and in Denver.
What kind of folks?
She went to Atlanta to campaign for a Karen Handel, who's running for the U.S. Senate, a woman she knew when Karen was Secretary of State, and so was Jan.
Uh-huh. Was there a primary in that?
Primary in that race.
So
in fact,
which side is she coming down on?
Well, she's coming down on the side of Karen, who is somewhere to the right of her, even on gun rights,
okay,
which is interesting.
Okay.
I know a little bit less about Cynthia Kaufman, who's running for Attorney General in Denver. She was there Friday to campaign for her and try to raise a little money for her. And I think we're going to be seeing a lot more of that in the next coming months. Once the special session is done, this governor sees herself on the national stage, and we'll have a harder time finding her.
Well, it's a logical place for her to go. She's term limited out here, and at the same time has gotten it's a national name that's known. 1070 and 1062 did that.
Let me go a step farther. She's got money. She has $300,000 in something called JANPAC, which is a federal political action committee that allows her to do independent expenditures on behalf of federal candidates. She has perhaps another $400,000 in something called Arizona's Legacy, which is a political action committee to help elect next governor and state lawmakers who side her way. So,
okay, you got us into now. In the break, you suggested that you think you know who she's going to endorse.
If she does an endorsement, and there's a lot of reasons why a governor doesn't want to get in the middle of a primary, I think it's going to be Scott Smith. And it has to do not so much of how she feels about some of the others, although she very clearly has an opinion on a few of them, but she's protecting her legacy. And Mary Jo and I were talking about this, the idea of Medicaid expansion, because if we don't do that, we're going to end up bankrupting the state in terms of taking care of these folks. And in terms of keeping Common Core, or as she calls it, Arizona's Career Readiness Standards, because we don't use that term, Common Core. And Scott Smith has been the one person to say, no, this isn't a plot out of Washington by the Obama administration. And there's nothing wrong with wanting to have students learn certain things by certain points in their careers.
Howie, all that reading and writing, that next thing you know, people are commencing to thinking, and then the legislature's in trouble.
I must say, with all due respect to Governor Brewer, I don't know how much her endorsement's would matter in a GOP primary. If she goes for Smith, and I think Howie makes a good case as to why he might be the logical recipient of that endorsement, your typical primary voter isn't necessarily a big Jan Brewer fan. I mean, the 1070 days, although that lives on nationally, you know, that's the Arizona voters, I think, have come a long ways away from that, and they're looking more at her vetoes of gun bills and where she's been on some of the education initiatives like Common Core, and she's not necessarily their cup of tea.
Isn't it interesting how immigration has kind of receded as a hot button issue?
Well, it will pop up again. For example, we've got a motion that was filed last week about the Dreamers and driver's license cases. But you have to remember, much of 1070 has been voided by federal courts. There's one provision, one key provision left. It's the papers, please provision, the one that says a police officer, if they've stopped someone, is supposed to check on the person's immigration status if there's reason to believe they're in the country illegally. That is still pending in a court, in Susan Bolton's court. But essentially, it's come down to how it's being enforced. We don't even know that there's a lot of enforcement going on. Sheriff Joe has been, had his wings trimmed by the federal court on what he can do. And so it's become sort of a non-issue. It was a hot button. It was a national issue when she signed it. We all went to the press conference she did at DPS. But you're right. It's sort of disappeared from the agenda in terms of more pragmatic things and the larger issue of just fighting the federal government over our rangelands, our public lands. Are we going to shoot wolves on our public lands? Who can we hunt and when?
And also the immigration debate really has been much more now back at the federal level, and that's taken some of the air out of some of the state arguments. I mean, how far can you go in this state? They've been trying for years, haven't gotten very far. So it's up to Congress where it's stalemated.
Well, Howie, Mary Jo suggested that Jan Brewer's endorsement may not be worth much. What do you think?
Well, that's a real problem in a primary. We know who turns out in the primaries for both parties. It's the wackadoodles on both ends of the spectrum. Now, I know it probably sounds horrible to say, but understand the folks who are willing to come out in an August primary or even vote early or are paying attention in August tend to be the true believers. Now, you also have fewer people left in the parties. I mean, you have more independents who, while they can vote in primaries, tend not to. So what you're left with are the true believers on each side. Only a small percentage of which actually turn out.
And those are not Jan Brewer fans.
And a lot of them are not. But here's the interesting thing that might work in Scott Smith's favor. If Ken Bennett stays in, if Ducey stays in, if Al Melvin gets his $5 donations and stays in, if Scott's in there, if Christine Jones, you know, who's got money, stays in, and you split the rightest of the right wing, that may be the best thing that Scott Smith's got going for him, because somebody with 18% could walk away with a nomination.
Howie's been listening to what I've been saying on this show.
split up
the other vote, and I like the arithmetic for the one guy who doesn't split up the vote.
Yeah.
So, Mary Jo, unfinished business, child welfare.
Child welfare is the big unfinished business, and it's the last piece of Jan Brewer's legacy. You know, as you know, CPS sort of very publicly blew up late last fall. Others would argue it blew up a long time before that. So we are expecting a special session late this month, maybe even early into June.
And the reason we're having that is that the legislature was unwilling to fully fund her ask.
Yes. Because the governor wanted about 80 some million dollars for child welfare purposes, and they gave her about $57, $59 million of it. But the other reason we're having a special session is that she asked for that, aside from the money. She wants a group to come up with a plan on how you extract CPS from the bureaucracy of the Department of Economic Security. And that's taken a while for that plan to emerge. So she wanted to just sort of put all that off into special session.
There were legislators who said, well, we're not fully funding because we don't see a fully fleshed out plan.
Right.
And then they also passed special legislation to conduct a study of what really happened, which she vetoed.
Yes, which she said that, and that special legislation for the $250,000 sort of review of CPS, that was a key idea from Senate President Biggs. It got through the legislature. She vetoed it last week and said, not a bad idea, but we really need to talk about it when we're having this special session because we got a lot of money issues to talk about. And I think that in this upcoming special session, the big debate will be over the money. It won't be so much the structure of child welfare. I think that's being hashed out now by this work group. But it'll be the money.
There's no real ideological issues.
Oh,
is there?
Yeah.
Not on the money. on the issue of how you structure it.
No, I beg to differ. Okay. I think that there's a big divide into do you take a more prosecutorial approach to any kind of report of child abuse? How heavy is it on law enforcement? How heavy it is on what they call the front door services or the preventive services? And the advocates of doing a lot more prevention and intervention like to note that about 80 to 85% of the cases coming in to the CPS hotline are neglect. They are not kids being beaten up, thrown in closets, left to rot
this
in lockers.
This is the mom who has a daytime job and the kid is, you got a young latchkey kid and
right,
stuff like
so what
that.
Do you do with the child? So I think there is a philosophical divide, and that's going to be bridged, allegedly, by this work group consisting mostly of lawmakers. They're meeting; they've been meeting on Fridays throughout the spring.
How active of a role is she taking? Is the governor taking in that?
Her chief of staff's overseeing the whole thing, okay. So to the extent that he's channeling her views, but I really don't know how much she sent directive to them.
But understood that this is also indicative of I've been covering this place since the early '80s, and we've had this perennial debate where. If you have a report of abuse or neglect, do you immediately rush in and take the child because the safety of that child is paramount? Or because if you don't and you end up with a headline, you end up with a Lori Roberts column, which nobody wants. Or do you say maybe we should provide more services to help the family, to keep the family together? And to the extent that families are kept together, there is a better long-term survival for that family. And this becomes inherent in the issue of do we prosecute? Do we make criminals out of parents and everything else? And this is a debate that is going to go back and forth. The pendulum has swung so many times, and we're never going to resolve that, at least not this session.
All right, we're going to tie a bow right around this big old package of this legislative wrap-up show when we come back right here in the Think Tank. Dr. Mike O'Neill, Mike Russell, News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
You're listening to the Think Tank on the Voice of Arizona. News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
A couple more issues that we have yet to cover. One of them was another attempt by the Republican legislative majority to vastly expand private school tuition vouchers. That got shut down, Howie.
That did. You have to remember, this has been incremental. The first bill that was passed was a very small program, and they call it education scholarship accounts because we don't use the V word here, please. And the idea was if you had students with special needs, foster children, disabilities, and you would provide the parents with essentially a credit card, a checking account to go out and buy educational services that maybe they couldn't get from the public schools. Well, there was a legal challenge to that, and it has faltered. So they have incrementally increased that. It now covers any student in a school that's rated D or F. Depending on whose numbers you're talking to, we could be talking over 100,000, maybe 200,000 kids who now are eligible, although there is a year-to-year
cap
on it.
But there's a big cap. Nowhere near that is eligible, unless I'm wrong.
No one is eligible until 2020 when the 1.5% year-over-year cap comes off. The big move this year was to go ahead and say, well, if you're in a school where a certain percentage of the kids are Title I, meaning low income, everybody becomes eligible. And depending on the numbers you used, you ended up with 850,000 of the 1.1 million kids.
In other words, that is the point at which this tiny little pilot program that's very targeted all of a sudden becomes potentially a huge part of the education system in the state.
And yes. From the perspective, and Mary Jo's talked to these same people, from the perspective of the education community, this is part of a secret or not so secret plan to destroy public education to the extent that you're taking the money out of public schools and putting it into vouchers. Supposedly 90% of what the kids were getting, but there's some funny stuff going on with the money there too.
You always have some issues of what do you count?
What do you count capital?
But
you've got the issue that you have public schools which are required to be funded in the state. There's a constitutional mandate, and you take kids out of schools. You have fixed costs there. You have buildings. You have teachers and everything else. And is this really a plan by people who do not trust public education? The teachers, they're Democrats, and they're teaching evolution, over there. I mean, we can't have that. And there are people who I think want to if not destroy, at least undermine the public education system.
And this comes against the backdrop of, you know, during the recession, the education budget is about half of the state budget anyway. Education took a big hit, about 18 to 19% cut in state revenues. They have got a long way to go to make that up. Even 5 years on, things have not improved vastly. So you have public schools, their advocates still working to boost the funding for that, and along come this expansion of the voucher program. And it set up a big battle. It wound up in the House. They voted it down just 2 weeks ago.
I think it was some of your writing. One of the things that I found most astounding about this was that the image was that this money is going to fund other alternative education. But evidently, a lot of parents were able to just take this money and sock it away and use it subsequent for college tuition.
It's legal. It's part of the law. You can save it for community college tuition. And some indeed are doing that.
Yeah. In other words, it's not funding any current educational activity at all. It just becomes a boon to parents who know how to play the system.
Well, yeah, and particularly if you're doing homeschooling, which is also permitted. I mean, this was the backdoor way of getting state funds into homeschooling. And so you tell the parents, well, you can buy services, you can buy books, you can buy tutors and things like that. And essentially, you're right. They finally put a provision in a bill that the governor signed just this past week to say parents must spend some of that. A portion is the term. Well, what's a portion? We don't know. Is a portion 2%, 5%, 10%? And so you still can have parents banking this money for down the road.
Okay. Real quick, another issue. Kimberly Lee Yee seemed to get egg on her face on the marijuana research issue.
Well, she's been all over the board on this. On one hand, she did sponsor legislation last year to create an exception from the law that says no marijuana on college campuses. She said if you're doing research has been blessed by the federal government and blessed by the university, you can do it there. Well, all of a sudden, Sue Sisley, who is a teacher at the University of Arizona College of Medicine, has most of the federal permission she needs to get to do the research, and now she's looking for money. She's saying, well, wait, we're gathering money every year for marijuana card users and dispensaries, so why not use that? And so she wanted to open the door to that, and all of a sudden Kimberly said, oh, over my cold dead body.
Right, and then all of which then led to a recall effort that was filed against Senator Yee a few weeks ago.
By military PTSD sufferers. I think that was the point at which she lost the kind of political high ground.
Right,
if you're anti-marijuana, maybe that's safe. But to be anti-veterans with PTSD... Wow.
Right. So very quickly, Yee scrambled to try to negotiate a settlement on this. She doesn't want this thing dogging her. She's up for election this fall. But that effort fell apart. The recall continues. It's well, wouldn't you know, just last week, a military veteran declares that he's running for the Senate as a Republican in that district. So he will be facing her in a primary.
So may not be the end of that one.
No, well, and the fact that, look, the recall is a dog and pony show. By the time you turn in the petitions, by the time you get them verified, by the time you call the election 90 to 120 days from there, we're already into the next session. Recalls do not survive sessions. So
it's a way of getting her some bad press.
Exactly.
It keeps the issue alive in her district, and that'll come into play in the primary. Primary elections, August 26th.
And in her district, whoever wins the primary is likely the winner.
Okay. We got a 3-4 minutes to go. Let's get to something interesting.
As opposed to marijuana?
Yeah, I thought we'd just stay on weed.
Pure politics. Is anybody in the Republican field distinguishing themselves at all? We've got 3 or 4 serious candidates. Has anybody done anything to distinguish themselves either positively or negatively?
You're talking about for the governor's race.
For the governor's race, yeah.
Yes, I think it all seems like vanilla out there. I would argue that perhaps Christine Jones stands out by virtue of her gender. She's the only woman that's running in the race, and she doesn't have a government background like the other so-called front runners.
So she gets to say once again that old saw about, well, I'll run government like a business. I know how to run a business.
Sure, and she spent some money. She's on the air with TV commercials, you know, and hitting the right grace notes for the Republican primary, balanced budget. I'm against illegal immigration. Enforce the laws. Trying to do that. Fact is, in some ways, sort of suggesting that she would continue Brewer's policies on immigration, which is funny because I'm not sure I see Jan Brewer endorsing her. But I think Mary Jo's right. You know, the only person who's sort of come out from the crowd a little bit has been Scott, only because of the fact he's refusing to toe the party line. And but in terms of publicity, maybe some of it's our fault in the media. It's been real hard for those of us who cover politics to start looking at a primary for late in the summer while the legislature's still in session. Now that we've got some time, you know, maybe it'll give us a little chance to kind of poke around and find out, well, what is Al Melvin's secret plan for the state, for example?
I don't know how interesting that is. I wonder, though, Kathy Herod's role on Doug Ducey's advisory committee. Do you think that becomes an issue, and is it a plus or a minus?
Well, Kathy's group technically does not endorse. They educate, you know, which also gets them around some campaign finance laws. They also don't contribute money. But those education things go out to a lot of churches. And in a low turnout primary, which we were just talking about, that can make a big difference. You know, who is the true...
Does this help Doug Ducey become the social conservative?
Certainly doesn't hurt him.
Yeah, I would agree. It doesn't hurt him. That portion of the Republican electorate that might be voting in the primary, having Herod's backing doesn't necessarily help you, especially when there are other choices.
What about Ken Bennett? We haven't talked about him. He's Secretary of State, number two position in state government,
yep.
And I think been pretty invisible on this campaign.
Well, he's been invisible on the airwaves, but he's out there. He is a big retail politician. He does. Somebody pointed out to me that earlier he goes to every event. He's glad hands. He's shaking hands. He's meeting people. And the few polls that have been done, both internally and publicly, show him as the top vote getter, probably by virtue of the fact that he is Secretary of State and has had his name out there.
And that name ID is important, but that retail politics, I went to an event for an annual party for the Jewish War Veterans of Sun Lakes. Swear to God, Ken Bennett was the only candidate there. He does understand what it means. He does understand, particularly since he's running with public funds, he's limited. Unlike Ducey, who probably have $2 million or more by the time the primary rolls around, if not sooner, he's limited to the $750,000 or so that he can get. He needs that earned media. He needs to be out there doing the things that he needs to do. Now, the problem of his press conferences is he had one where he said he was going to eliminate the state income taxes, cut the state sales tax, but couldn't seem to make the math work.
You're talking about Bennett.
Yes, Bennett, yeah. Yes.
And there you have it, a look back and a look forward. Check that out. See, that's how we do it here on the Think Tank. on behalf of all of us, thank you to our three guests. Thank you, Dr. Mike O'Neill. We appreciate it. I'm Mike Russell. This is The Think Tank on News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
Thank you.